Alt NPR.
The following is an installment of Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
The first time my cell phone unintentionally dials someone up is when I'm in the bathroom of a bus from Boston to New York City. It's late at night and the bus is dark. I use my cell phone to light my way in the bathroom so I can see where the toilet is. But as I am relieving myself, I accidentally hit the call button, and my cell phone rings up the woman whom I'm en route to visit. It still pains me to imagine her picking up the phone, seeing that it's me on the caller ID, and sweetly answering, "Hello, are you almost here?" And then, the sound of rushing urine. When I get back to my seat, she calls me in tears. I'm unable to dissuade her that in fact I do not have a golden shower fetish, and that my phone call was not a passive-aggressive attempt to turn her out. But when I finally arrive at her building, her doorman informs me that I'm not to be allowed in. I never see her again. Ever since this unfortunate occurrence, I've tried to make sure I lock my cell phone whenever I'm not using it. But I often forget. Even today, this very afternoon, after everything I just went through this past weekend, I received a text message from my friend Leanne telling me, "Your phone keeps calling me up, and I'm hearing your conversation." But I'm already getting ahead of myself. We need to start this story at its proper place. 2 months ago, right about when I began this stupid Adventures in Surveillance series. I have a meeting in Washington, D.C. It's a noon meeting, and so my plan is to take the train back to New York City when it's over. But before heading home, I take the metro out to Silver Springs, where a few of my friends are attending the Silver Docks Documentary Film Festival. And just as I arrive, I find them outside the main theater. They have an extra ticket for me to go in and hear Al Gore give a keynote speech, and so I accompany them in. After the speech, my friend James, who has to fly to San Francisco, gives me his festival badge, and my friend John assures me that he can get me into the Jim Jarmusch-Martin Scorsese event later in the evening, and so I decide to stick around. We do indeed get into the event, and when it's over, John and I make our way to the after party. Now, my only Washington, D.C. friend, Chris Beck, is out of town, and John is staying with family friends, so I have no place to crash. I figure I have only enough time for one or two drinks before I need to leave for the train station. Unless I can find the beautiful woman I noticed earlier in the day, sitting a few rows from me during the Al Gore speech. Perhaps I can find her at this after party and convince her that she should invite me to stay with her. I tell John my plan, and he mockingly suggests that if I do find her, I should walk right up to her and say, "Look, I have this dilemma." But as soon as he says this, I catch sight of her, standing aloof in one of the drink lines. And so I walk over and start up a conversation. Her name is Rebecca, and it turns out that we have a few mutual friends in public radio. And even though she's essentially working for the film festival, she's amused that my name does not match the one on the badge around my neck, and thus it seems completely natural for me to take her by the arm and say to her, "Look, I have this dilemma." A few hours later, we're smoking cigars in her convertible. The drive to her DuPont Circle apartment is more Mulholland Drive than Rock Creek Park, but eventually we make it, in one piece. I end up staying with Rebecca for the entire film festival, and on Sunday she drives me back to New York City. And when she finally heads home on Tuesday, she's decided to quit her job making propaganda for the government and move to New York to pursue her lifelong dream of becoming a stand-up comedian. The following weekend she comes up to visit again, and then I take the bus to visit her for the 4th of July. We talk on the phone and text message each other every day. I spend many a night sitting on my front stoop just thinking about how good the universe is to me and how lucky I am. Okay, So that's pretty much Act 1. And believe you me, my dear listeners, I am just as uncomfortable sharing with you this happy little tale as I am sure you are of listening to it. So let's proceed quickly to Act 2, which contains the more familiar despair and desolation. Like I said, I spend many a night out on the stoop in front of my building. And well, about 2 weeks ago, late one evening, I'm smoking a cigar and contemplating things out on said stoop when a strange woman comes up and asks me if I will let her into the building. She tells me she's trying to get a hold of Ray, who lives on the first floor, because she's staying with him and he isn't answering his telephone. Now, something is not right about this woman. First of all, her luggage is more or less homeless vintage, which is of course by no means an offense. This is, after all, the East Village, but she's also chugging a bottle of NyQuil. But who am I to pass judgment on what particular substance a person chooses to imbibe? So I let her into the building. She pounds at Ray's door for a few moments and then comes back outside and sits down next to me. She takes out her cell phone and pretends to dial a number, but I can clearly see that the device is turned off. Then she lights up a cigarette and begins to flirt with me. She asks me what my name is and what I do and what my sign is and what apartment I live in. I tell her that I live in apartment 8, when in truth, I live in number 7. Then she tells me that if she can't get a hold of Ray, then she doesn't have a place to stay for the night. I let this hang in the air for a moment before rising to my feet. I tell her that I'm sure Ray will be home shortly. And then, without looking at her, I turn and let myself into the building. That night, Jesus makes an appearance in my dream, and he's totally pissed off. Did I not recently reward you with a place to stay when you were in need in Washington, D.C., he shouts. Do I not treat you well? Have I not directed the universe to accord unto you multiple blessings and fortunes? Does it not say in the fucking Bible that I will come into the world disguised as a beggar and woe be unto he who would deny me? His eyes are wild and terrifying, and I'm speechless before him. The following night, I'm given a second chance. Once again, I'm smoking a cigar out on the stoop. Once again, this strange woman shows up, and once again, my neighbor Ray does not answer the buzzer or his phone. Only tonight, she's forsaken the NyQuil in favor of what has to be either crack cocaine or paint thinner. I notice this when she collapses on top of me. When I'm finally able to get her upright and seated on the stoop beside me, she takes out a piece of cake from her bag and rams it into her mouth. She doesn't even finish chewing before coming straight out with it. Can I crash on your couch? So there it is. The gauntlet is thrown down. I opt to hedge. I tell her that actually I don't own a couch and that all I have are wooden chairs, extremely uncomfortable wooden chairs at that, but she waves this nonsense aside and says she will be fine with sleeping on my floor. I stand up and tell her that actually my girlfriend will be getting off work from the bar in about an hour and will not like the idea of finding a strange woman sleeping on the floor of my apartment. She waves this aside as well. Just let me crash on your floor for 45 minutes, she pleads. No, I say, and then I go back inside. That night, I do not dream of Jesus. But the next morning, the very next morning, my boss calls me up to tell me that come September 1st, my job is going to be put on hiatus, and thus I am going to be unemployed for the foreseeable future. I can hear Jesus snickering on another extension on the line. And when my boss hangs up, he laughs. Ha ha ha, now who's going to be homeless? I phone my dear Rebecca in DC to tell her about my new dilemma, but I am unable to reach her. So I send her an instant message. But even though the computer says she's there, I get no response. I can feel the tremors of a sea change. By 4 o'clock, I'm wandering the streets in total despair, taking note of the park benches and dumpsters that will surely soon be my new living quarters. But then, in front of a bar on 7th Street. I meet a sculptress named Annie who, over the course of a few vodka tonics, provides me with an opportunity to go into a state of total denial. And the following morning, I wake naked on the floor of her studio. Now, normally I would never share such sordid details from my personal life with you, my dear listeners, but alas, this discretion on my part is pertinent to the story. For you see, the following day comes and goes, and yet I still do not hear from my dear Rebecca. I send her a few text messages and I leave her a voicemail, but I receive not a single response. By early evening, I'm at the point of mental and physical exhaustion, and so I decide to get some sleep so that the following morning I will be refreshed enough to worry and fret at full throttle. When I finally am able to get out of bed on Friday, I still have nothing from Rebecca. No emails, no text messages, no voicemails, nothing. I start to wonder what possibly could be happening. Could Jesus be this angry with me? Am I to lose both my livelihood and my lover in one fell swoop? By evening, I'm in a total panic. I even scan the Washington, D.C. news sites to see if she's fallen victim to the city's recent crime wave. I just can't comprehend what could be the reason for her silence. And then, it hits me. On the night I spent with Annie the sculptress, I accidentally rolled over my cell phone and, after a few moments before shutting it off, I noticed that it was lit. Truly a masterful stroke of genius for a vengeful Jesus, to make me a victim of my very own adventure and surveillance. I go to singular.com to confirm my horrible hypothesis. But unfortunately, some of the relevant data is missing. According to the fine print, details on calls made to other providers can take up to 6 business days to show up on the statement. All I am able to discern is that on the night in question, my phone did indeed make a few out-of-area calls, one of which was for 7 minutes. But at this point, I do not need confirmation. There is no need to substantiate my suspicions. No need to prove the paranoia. It is obvious that my cell phone had dialed Rebecca up and that she had answered only to hear me doing God knows what with some other woman. There can be no other explanation. Friday night, I am once again visited by Jesus. Only this time, he has Rebecca with him. They're both wearing combat fatigues and both are armed with automatic weapons. Jesus has a 1984 vintage ghetto blaster slung over his shoulder. He plays a few moments from my phone call for me. It turns out that it was actually recorded onto Rebecca's voicemail. She tells me that she's going to post it on the internet and that she's already even purchased a domain. BenjaminWalkerIsATotalFraud.com. Jesus tells me that he's going to help her rent the apartment across the hall from me so that whenever I bring someone home, Rebecca will be able to offer first-hand testimony about my shortcomings, both as a lover and as a human being. I awaken Saturday morning, totally broken and beaten. I decide to send Rebecca one last text message. One that will suggest to her that I know what is going on, but one that is vague enough to take the 0.000001 chance that this whole situation actually has nothing to do with an unintended cell phone call into account. This is what I send. Ha ha, dash. This is the best surveillance story yet. But I don't get a response. Which means, of course, that it is all true, and that she is already advancing against me. I decide against leaving any more voice messages, as surely they will only end up fodder for more degradation on YouTube or MySpace. And surely she has plans to telephone all of my friends and colleagues to share my secrets and all the bad things I've said about them behind their backs. Surely it is all over for me. I sit on the floor of my apartment for hours contemplating the various ways in which I can kill myself with little pain. Until finally, at 7:45 p.m., I get a text message from Rebecca. This is what it says. You know, get my SMS? Question mark. I am with ex-boyfriend's best friend, who I might be in love with, dash. So dealing with that, dash. Sorry not to tell you earlier, dash. Hope you are okay, dash. Talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
Alt.